Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 15th, 2002. Today we have a community forum in the village entitled, What is Sex Good For? Conducted by Gail Gammoth McCoy and Ingrid Christensen. The tape number is FO2002-37. Let's listen in.
Johnson, and I will be chairing the forum this evening. And the forum, roll the tape. I don't know, are they taping this? The topic of the forum is, what is sex good for? The purpose of a forum at Holden Village is to have an open conversation among people of varying points of view about topics of contention, or interest, or trouble, or the sorts of topics that in society we're having to struggle with these days. And that can vary completely. It can be war, it can be peace, it can be sex. And in this occasion it is. The forums can take other forms in other occasions, like we sometimes have joke forums, but this is not one of those. This is a real forum about ideas. I think that an ideal candidate to chair a forum at Holden is someone who has no opinion about the subject whatsoever, and unfortunately I'm not one of those. I have lots of opinions about sex. But I don't think anybody would be able to chair a forum on sex and have no opinion. So I figure I'm as good as anyone. The idea came up to have a forum, What is Sex Good For? When we were talking among us on the teaching staff this week about all the negative stuff around sex. We know perfectly well as a people what sex is bad for. We know, for example, that sex can kill you. We know that sex is often characterized as sick, and that there is sick sex, and that sex can make you sick. That's tough to say. That sex is often associated with the word assault, sexual assault. That there's trafficking in sex, and that it's degrading and destructive of the human spirit. That sex sells cars and other things. Sex sells practically everything. If you spend any time reading magazines or watching the television, you'll know that. We know that sex is often characterized as degrading, that sex is thought to be embarrassing. In fact, this is an unusual forum because ordinarily when we have a forum about sex at Holden, all the adults sit in the balcony. And they're not tonight. There are a number of youth in the balcony, but I don't see many older adults, at least, in the balcony. All the young adults out there.
You're getting hard on
them. We hear about sex too soon. We know about young sex. So we know all the negative things. So, as one of my children said in a meeting of ninth graders that I was chairing at one point, what is sex good for? Why would you ever have sex? Because it's so obviously bad. Now, we've got to believe as people of faith that sex is a gift from God. Our ability to have sex is a gift from God. So it seems to us that we need to talk about, as Christians together, what it's good for. What is it good for in marriage? We never talk about sexuality in marriage. I was the chair of the Division for Church and Society for the ELCA at the time that we wrote the human sexuality statements, or we attempted to. And there are many stories out of that period and of the history of our church, but one of them is nobody would ever talk about sex within marriage. That was absolutely taboo, because it's assumed that if you're a Christian, you have nothing to do with sex whatsoever until you're married, and then you have a wonderful sex life.
Okay.
We all know how true that is. So, sex in committed relationships. What's appropriate sexuality as teenagers, as young adults, as older adults, in committed relationships, of homosexual relationships. All of those kinds of things, we just have a hard time talking about good sex. So, we have a panel of experts here tonight. Who will each...
Who will no surrogates today.
Each help us kick off this topic with about 2 to 3 minutes apiece of ideas about this topic. This is a topic about which no one has an answer, and everyone has ideas, and we're totally counting on everyone in the room to brainstorm, to think about this together, to bring up good ideas. But the first good ideas we're going to ask for are from our three panelists, who are Winston Covert?
Cavert.
I can't read my own writing ever. Who is a doctor and a professor and a clinician who works in Minneapolis, and his primary area of work is in some of the negative sexual side effects, which is in sexually transmitted diseases, especially HIV/AIDS, but tonight has agreed to think about what sex is good for, and he has some good ideas. Trixie Folden, who is a bio major at Iowa State, and who's a smart and sensible and warm-hearted, thoughtful young person who will report to us something out of what she's thought about sex and about her fellow young people and her sister young people. And these are all invitational voices that we hope will invite everyone into the conversation. And Gail Gamuth McCoy, who has been another person who's been an expert in negative stuff on sex this week here at Holden, who also will think of, she's been teaching the sessions on trafficking in prostitution, and she will help us think about positive uses of sex or what sex is good for. So I think we'll start out with Winston for his 3 minutes, and then we'll go to Trixie, and then to Gail, and then we'll open it up for discussion. And we would ask one more thing, that you try to get that we try to get as many voices into the conversation as possible, so that no one person dominates, and on the other hand, everyone feels invited in.
Well, thank you for that nice introduction. I guess I was hoping that maybe we would start off with someone who talked a little bit more on the personal level about what's good about sex. When I heard when somebody saw the title out on the kiosk that they said, well, what's good? What is sex good for? The answer is it's fun and for making babies. That's close case. I think there's certainly two aspects of the personal part of that that's important, and I think I'm going to leave some of the other personal positives for other people to fill in. One personal thing that sex is clearly good for in my life, and I think in the life of famous lovers through history, and that is friendship. Sometimes in this fast-paced world and doing, you know, having a very busy life, it's hard to keep connections with all sorts of friends, but one friendship that I always have access to is the friendship that's built on my sexual relationship with my wife. And that's something that I think the sexuality or the sex in our life helps to bind and maintain that friendship. Obviously, if that was all that was there, it wouldn't be much of a friendship. But that's a key component of maintaining that primary friendship in my life. And then as I started to think, to move away from the personal a little bit, as I started to think about other aspects of what sex is good for, I started to think about other sort of levels or categories. One is, as a biologist, sex is clearly good for our survival as a species and for the diversity of God's created world. And maybe I'll leave it at that, but you know, in some very fundamental way, who we are as a species, on a biological sense, is obviously intrinsically connected to sex and to our sexual behavior. And then a couple other thoughts that I had on a more sort of a social level. I guess as a biologist or a scientist, I tend to think in systems theory, so I work things up and down levels of relationship. But on a social level, I think sex has a capacity to provide social creativity. And I think some concrete examples of that. One is that a number of, because I work in the area of HIV, a number of my patients are gay males. And I work in a city where being a gay male is increasingly becoming a open and an affirmed event. And in fact, the gay community in Minneapolis-St. Paul has been a major force in a artistic and cultural renaissance, at least in some parts of the Twin Cities, in several neighborhoods in particular. And there's a fundamental driving, creative and wonderful energy that comes from that particular community within my hometown. And As I reflected on that, I wonder, now, is that energy partly a sexual energy? And I think it is. I think that there's a sexual energy that runs between individuals, between two individuals. There's also a sexual energy that runs within communities. And I think that that one obvious manifestation of that in our culture right now is within the gay community, both locally in my city and nationally. And perhaps the reason is that, or reason why that's so manifest right now, it seems to me, is that after a group of people have been repressed, their sexuality has been repressed, their ability to be sexual, publicly sexual individuals has been repressed in a society, and then that starts to open up and become freed, that there is a sexual creativity that gets manifest in a number of different areas of society. So in the Twin Cities, for example, in theater, in areas of visual art, in commerce, in cooking and restauranteering, and so forth. So that's one area that I think sex is good for. Another area that's cultural or social that I think sex is good for is politically. And there's a similar sort of driving sexual force behind some of the political movements of our time. And just three quick examples. One is, again, from the area of HIV/AIDS. I don't think it's a coincidence that HIV was the first sort of major medical disease that developed a driving political advocacy behind it. And I think part of that energy has been a released or an available sexual energy in that. And I don't think it's coincidence that the second major disease that has developed that kind of political advocacy is breast cancer. And then finally, one example, if I've got another half a minute. There is a, in the last month or two, we've heard from Nigeria, from the Igbo land in Nigeria, about women who are challenging the local economic dominance and the oppressiveness of particularly American energy companies, oil companies like Shell and at least one or two others. In their area, where the money gets also, or the oil gets pumped out and shipped overseas, and there's no local development or local empowerment that comes out of that oil that's taken from their region, and those women have used their sexual gender roles and notions of sexuality in that society by threatening to unclothe themselves in front of the management of those companies in their area. And by doing that, they have really opened an amazing dialogue and an amazing possibility for repatriating some of the resources from their own community back to the benefit of their community. And there's a political sexual energy that's behind that, I think. So, some ideas.
Given us a lot to think about. Trixie.
Okay. I guess I hadn't thought that deeply since snack bar this afternoon. When she first came to me and asked me to think about something good about sex, the only thing I could think about, which wasn't really positive, was the Britney Spears, like, 12-year-old girls running around in the really low jeans and tank tops that don't really fit. And it took a long time, I guess, and conversation with my dinner table to think of things that were positive about sex. And one that we thought of was that it's more open and publicly accepted to discuss sex, and sexual education is coming at a younger age, especially from schools and parents, as opposed to learning about sex from watching movies or TV, which in many cases, actually in almost all cases, is nothing at all what sex should be about. It should be an intimate thing, not something that you videotape and broadcast over a big screen, you know, type of thing. The other thing we talked about was sex for people like younger, from like 0 to 30 in that age group, that when you start like little kids, teaching them that hugging is okay and holding hands is okay and things like that, so it's not such a faux pas to be close to other people. Because when I was little, growing up, I know we did the good touch, bad touch thing and had little, like, mannequin doll type things they would bring into our schools. And it seemed like such a horrible, horrible thing. And then you see it on TV and you go, well, is my teacher right? Or is this movie that I'm watching correct? And it seems like as education gets younger, yes, it's bringing sex to kids at an earlier age, but for the most part, the kids that I've dealt with already know all about it, and they're in, like, third grade. And it's not something that their parents have said or their school has said. It's something they've seen on TV, saw in a music video, something like that. So, I don't know. My sex is good that we're starting education earlier, starting to inform kids of real facts, stuff they don't tell you in, you know, TV shows, that people get AIDS and people get STDs and bad things can happen. And I think it's something they should be informed of instead of just seeing it being glamorous and, you know, great on TV.
Good. More good things to think about and starters for our conversation. Gail.
Hello, good evening. And a little bit more about me. I am the ED of Genesis Health, but I also am a licensed psychotherapist, and I used to appear on television as a relationship expert. So some of the things that I learned through that was a lot of often relationship problems and marital problems had to do with miscommunications about, as you so well put it, that friendship that develops around sexuality. And beyond that, one of my friends was doing the paper in Anchorage, Alaska, worked with the police force there, and they began to query or ask the gentleman, why were you going to prostitute? And in 50% of the cases, the men said, because I can't get oral sex at home, which was kind of an interesting response. So what we're thinking about, thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So what we're thinking about, I mean, it is, I think almost sometimes with people that are here, maybe not, we're almost preaching to the choir in terms of healthy sexuality and what's healthy, but the reality is that if you watch a TV show like Sex and the City, for example, may contemplate buying a pair of shoes, that's a bigger decision than who they're going to go to bed with, or, that's an easy decision. Of course, I'm going to his apartment, you know. And despite the best efforts of a lot of people, and despite the fact that we're talking to kids about sex earlier, the reality is that our pregnancy rates for young people are going up in this country, that popular culture and media, music, television, film, none of that seems to be following suit. So I guess what I'm saying is it's good, and more, I don't know if more children are being snatched off the streets and raped and murdered, or if there's just more media attention about that. But it seems that despite well-meaning and sex education programs and all the good things that are going on, there seems to be some gap or something that's not happening when you just really look at basic statistics and numbers about what's going on with our children, turning on the TV, turning on the film. So sort of what I'm interested in, because of my line of work, is do people also have creative ideas? I think if you have a healthy, non-dysfunctional family, those messages do get sent, but I think also the unhappy situation in our country is that there's a lot of dysfunctional families where those messages are not getting sent. So I'm always kind of thinking about not, again, preaching to the choir, the healthy people that are sending good messages, but how do we, as a community and as Americans and as parents and as adults and all of that, try and turn the tide about. And again, I don't think the expose in the Catholic Church, again, I don't think the Catholic priests, I know it's not just Catholic priests, but I do know that there's an epidemic of pedophilia in our country. So, and I can't say on the healthy side, people who are sexually healthy don't do those things, but there's an awful lot of people that are. So how do people that are healthy and want to send healthy messages, how do we impact others in society and protect children and have healthy attitudes about sex? And again, non-Victorian attitudes. We were talking a little bit in our other workshop about the way men are treated when they solicit a prostitute and how they're treated in a very Victorian, punitive, print his picture, put his picture on the internet, take his car, and all of these kinds of very Victorian negative attitudes. And maybe that person is someone who grew up in an unhealthy home. A lot of times you'll hear a man who does that say, well, my father took me, I sat in the car while my father visited a prostitute. And that's how I learned to do that. So does he really need to be punished, or is there some kind of another type of intervention where I think sex is coming out in the open, but I still think we're a long way from really openly having healthy sexual attitudes and teaching kids, again, fear about AIDS. I think just what she said, there's a lot of fear, don't get sick, don't get STDs, don't get that, this, that, and the other thing. But our numbers and what sociologists and what is happening in our country tells us that we're not succeeding right now. So I'm really open to hear some good ideas and good suggestions about making the world a more sexually healthy place, which I guess is the positive note, and how we do that, and how we impact not just our backyard, not just our house, and not just our own children. Because I think we can do that, but we have a tendency with sex to say it's not our business what other people are doing, but really it is our business. And especially what's happening to the children in this country, it is our business when little kids get taken off the street and raped and murdered. That is our business. And the person who did that was extremely unhealthy and extremely sick. Why did he fall through the cracks, What do we need to be paying attention to? So that's, I'm always interested in ideas.
Thank you, Gail. Thank you. Well, we've gone on the length up here, and now it's your turn. So who would like to bring up a topic or a question or teach us something?
I've got, I've helped with the youth group from 7th grade to 12th grade for the past 8 years. And we were doing a mock debate at a retreat, and I lost a very teachable moment, but I think it was appropriate that I lost it. The debate, we had the kids debate pro and con about sexual education in schools, and one of the 10th graders made a comment that at the time it was inappropriate for me to jump on because of the age range and the situation we were in, but I wished it had been appropriate, because in one of the things that they were talking about in the sex education thing, he brought up that he was on the pro-sex education, and he used the phrase that sex is no big deal. And I think that, yes, we're educating kids a lot earlier about the biological facts and the disease facts, but I think that what we're missing the boat on is the emotional and the spiritual facts of sex. And I've got friends who've got teenage kids, and you know, I've got one friend, a close friend, who's got a daughter who got herself in a situation where she ended up having sex where she didn't intend to, and it was her first experience, and she was scared to death afterwards that she was going to have to be pregnant or have some disease, and it just, you know, her thing was it just happened. And in my experience in talking to these teenagers that I've been working with, it's, we don't ever talk about the emotional or the spiritual ramifications of sex. And I don't have any great answers for that, but I think that, you know, in all the education that we do about the disease process, we don't talk about the soul process. And I think in a healthy sexual relationship, that is such a big part of it. It's that friendship connection thing. And we don't ever, it doesn't sound so, we don't ever, I don't think we, in my experience, we haven't really talked about it enough.
Exactly. And that's one thing that it would be wonderful if we could talk about a little tonight. So I wonder if anybody would like to pursue that and talk anything about the emotional or spiritual ramifications of sex, Mary.
Kind of a just a side comment instead of head on. I'm a school teacher, and I absolutely agree with you that it's so important that those aspects be addressed. And I'm sure everyone knows that in the public schools, we absolutely are gagged and tied and bound. And we are utterly restricted from saying almost anything. And
so all of us who want to leave it to someone else to do with our kids cannot leave it to the public schools. Mm-hmm. Well, so that
I haven't found that to be true in the public schools where I'm at.
So you're a different state, probably.
Right. I'm in Oregon. It's been, however, it's been a very fine line for me because I absolutely cannot say anything about spiritual or religious. And that is a fine line. Those of us who are churched walk in that profession. But we do have some wonderful programs that talk with kids about healthy living and safe living.
So if your public school needs to get some of those materials, get her address.
I would say in my district, it's the fundamentalist Christians that are the stifling effect in our district. We live in it's a very fundamentalist community and staff in my building. And I like what you said up there too, but I think we are addressing the emotional part. But we're not doing it as educators or families, we're doing it through the media. We give total mixed messages in our society. In my building, they want people to say no to sex. That is sex education. Just say no, basically. And then they go home and turn on the TV, where sex is fun, sex is exciting, sex sells clothes, sex sells music, it sells everything. So in our culture, I see us saying no on one hand, and go for it big time, because it's great fun on the other hand, and it will fulfill your emotional needs.
Yes, I should say realistic emotion.
Right,
yeah.
But they're getting that message, you know.
Yeah.
They're getting, as a parent, man, I talk a lot blue in the face. But
I've heard my college students from Carleton and St. Olaf and places like that talk about recreational sex, which I thought was an interesting phrase.
Many kids in my building do not believe oral sex or anal sex is sex.
Right.
It's just that.
Well, and because President Clinton, you know, I did not have sex with that woman one time, you know. And that became a popular, and even imitating Monica Lewinsky wearing her, you know, beret and buying Kate Spade bags, and she made Kate Spade a billionaire for carrying her bags.
Can anyone else address this issue of emotional and spiritual growth and sex or cherishing and all the stuff around sex that would be emotion spiritual? What would we say?
Well, for me personally, as a person that was abused sexually as a child, that has brought a very interesting perspective of sexuality from the great deal of power. Each of you have mentioned something about the power of the sexuality. And I think this, the real elements of some of the sexuality stuff that I deal with is the soul-killing component of it and the soul-enriching component of it.
And tonight we're trying to focus on the enriching.
Well, the enriching component of it for me maybe has not completely occurred yet. However, I've found this through having a better sense of self and a better sense of my own dignity to be able to respond to another person kindly, appropriately, lovingly. And I think that kind of comes from, you know, my studies. I'm a practicing massage therapist, and I'm also a firefighter. So I have this warm, sensitive side thing, and then I also have, you know, run into burning buildings mania. So I think the better handle I get on myself of who and what I am and who and what I can be to someone else, friendship-wise, sexually, sexually entertaining, sexually for, you know, reproduction, and of course there's that power balance, flip-flop of sexual stuff.
Thanks. I'm going to just make a list of the positive words I hear about sex tonight, and I'll read them back to you at the end of the call. So I've started. I've got a few words from you. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing up the yin yang. So there's always two sides to everything.
Good.
For me, the Catholic understanding of sexuality as a sacrament, that is the physical element that makes Christ's love known in an intimate relationship. I guess I find very helpful that our marriage relationship is so important that my marriage partner is the most important person to, or one of the most important persons to making Christ known to me, Christ's love known to me in our marriage relationship, which of course is more than sexuality, but I think, you know, the Lutheran Church has not chosen to see marriage as a sacrament because of some of the problems with that, and I'm not saying we should see it that way, but I think there's something helpful there in saying that that Christ's love is made known through a marriage love, part of which is sexuality.
That's very good. Thank you.
Can you say something?
Yes.
I'm a resident in Genesis House, and I'm no longer an active prostitute, but I am in recovery. And being in Genesis House, what I've learned is that I need to befriend myself, and I like what you were saying, fire slash massage, that it starts within myself. And if I learn to, when I get a hold and embrace myself and my self-worth and my values, then I know when a relationship begins, I know what I want out of a relationship, and that you have to have an open mind and become a friend first to myself, to my higher power, and then I'll be able to be there for somebody else and be open to, you know, be there to allow somebody to be there for me. But only till I know what I want and who I am, that's the only way I'm going to receive it. If I don't know, you know, because being an active prostitute, I didn't know none of that. You know, in sex, I abused it to the fullest. And, you know, it's just about, you know, learning to love myself. And if I learn to love myself, then I'm going to attract that type of person to me.
Thank you.
Carol, did you have your hand up?
No, but I have something. It just strikes me that a key difference here is that healthy sexuality and healthy sexual relationships are about making connections with people, whereas a lot of the stuff that we're talking about being the negative stuff is about using sex as a commodity or using sex as entertainment. And the idea of the oral sex not being sex or the anal sex not being sex, in a sense, it's not. It's an activity that doesn't have something to do with having a broader connection with the other person. And, you know, to focus on, and that's what you see, I think, in music videos, just some people, well, the little bit that I've seen of them, but is, you know, that there's a lot of sort of... making it a commodity, making it an activity, making it entertainment, but it doesn't show a relationship. It doesn't show a connection.
But those kinds of sex that you were talking about can show. I mean, can be relational, can be mutual, can be changed.
Right, they can be, exactly. But someone was talking earlier about how in high schools, you know, kids have bets about how many times they're going to have oral sex and who can have the most in one day, 5 times behind the locker, station. I mean, that's not, I don't think, people making connections with each other.
Right. It's like what Ingrid said, the recreational.
Right.
Recreational sex. And that, incidentally, is when we talk about oral sex and assume that we mean that, we're talking about something being done to somebody's penis.
Right. Not to their whole person.
Right. But we're not talking about something being done to anybody's labia or clitoris or vagina. I mean, there's no oral sex in that context. Doesn't mean something done to women. It's done to men. So it's important to me to get both sides and
right,
have a little egalitarian approach to oral sex.
Well, maybe, to change this tenor a little bit, I've got a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old. But to be very frank with them about sex, and the thing that disturbed me more than anything, and maybe this shouldn't be a surprise because we use it as in our humor so much in our culture, it's a funny thing. When my son and I are talking about it, there's a lot of humor, good humor, healthy humor involved between us. My wife and I have, we've adopted children, and we had about 4 miscarriages between us. I've lost the count, actually. And I've been fixed, so I can't impregnate her anymore. I had a vasectomy. And I explained this to my son, and he's made the assumption that we don't have sex anymore. And, I said, we did. He said, why? And I just looked at him and said, well, it's fun. And we both just roared, and it was just so healthy. And it's going to be funny, too. I mean, it's in a real healthy way.
That's nice. There you are. Okay.
I don't know about how to deal with people in unhealthy families, because this is only something that would come from a healthy family, but I was really impressed with my girlfriend's approach to her sons. She, when it was time as a single parent to talk to them about sexuality, she didn't just talk to them about the biological, here's what the various parts do, and then you get a baby. She talked about how to be a tender lover, how to be gentle and sensitive and thoughtful and anticipate your partner's needs and bring them pleasure and interact in a respectful way. And I just was blown away that she would talk to a 14-year-old boy that way.
How wonderful. What a nice string of adjectives you ran on there, too.
You know, I think one of the places, one of the things that sex is really important for is it's sort of an ongoing practicum for consideration, for relationship, how to go about relationships. So, you know, what one does in one's sex life is a sort of a constant training for what you do with the rest of the world, you know, or other relationships in your life, for how to interact with people. Not necessarily the physical component, but the sort of consideration attitudes behind that.
So it's very relational, is what I hear you saying, that it's the mutuality and relationality of it puts us into sensitivity with one another.
Yeah, sensitivity training, that's good.
Okay.
Yes.
One of the things that I heard a couple of people say was that maybe the school is not really one in charge of the sex education, and the home is the one that is supposed to help address that.
Which is why we're all here practicing.
Also need to emphasize, if you are from the abused family, or if you are from a dysfunctional family, then you have to find other avenues of getting your education out through sex education.
Thank you.
Because if you attend or come from an abused family, that's the only thing you all know how to deal with another woman, another person of the opposite sex. Is abuse if you've been with abuse all your life, growing up as a young person.
Very helpful reminder. Thank you, Mark. Let's just add to that whoever is your sexual choice or object, it doesn't have to be someone of the opposite sex, but whoever's the person that you cherish and want to express your love to. You and then you. I can't see either one of you, but I can hear you.
It's like a big black void.
I'm a high school teacher, and it's funny because I feel like I'm in this sexual environment every day of my life because my kids talk about it every day. And back when I was in high school, we didn't really talk about it. And yet my kids do all the time, and they say all these things, which just flabbergast me. I'm like, my God, I'm standing right here. I can hear you. Did you really want me to hear you say that? And they say, yeah. And they compare partners, and they compare actions, and all these other things. And it just, I'm just amazed. There's just no boundaries anymore in terms of public discussion. And I think back to when I was in high school, and I chose not to be sexually active, but it was largely because it was like a clique. Like, if you were, that put you in one group, and if you weren't, that put you in another group. And it really didn't have anything to do with that per se. It was, which image did you want to have? If you wanted to have the right image, then you either chose to or not to, to fit that image. And, you know, there were the people who drank, and there were the people who had sex, and there were people who studied. But it was like you couldn't do both. I mean, and I didn't know that. And it was so weird when I got to be an adult and I realized they were intellectual and, you know, all these other things. And they have sex too. You know, because it was so divided when I was a student. And, you know. So, anyway, I guess something else I want to respond to is that I can't believe as a teacher that we think we can't talk about it in school, because everybody else is talking about it, all the kids are, and it's there in the environment so strongly, and so, my God, you've got to have it there, because that's where it's going to happen.
Can I ask a question? Do those cliques still exist, or
is everybody to know, but I would say generally yes. I don't know if it's, you know, obviously my vision has changed a little bit. But I remember one girl I had in class who dressed very scantily and all these other things. And I remember the other kids called her a whore when she wasn't right there, kind of to her back, but I could hear it. And so, and other kids knew this. They're like, oh yeah, I know who that is.
Research Camp. That's right, that's who she is. So I assume that these, you know, labels still exist.
So here's slut too.
Well, I appreciated hearing the word power over here, because that put something with me. I believe that sex requires vulnerability, going the opposite direction of power, and in that, there's a very intense bond created between two people.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. And it seems true to me.
That's adding a few more words to our list.
I'd like to make a response to the high school thing, since I'm probably one of the people in the room who's closest to being out of high school recently.
Go, Trixie.
And I guess I can identify with you as saying there are distinct, like, groups of people that do different, distinct things, but I think a lot of it has become, like, muddled together, where, like, our valedictorian was definitely one of the people who was partying every week and doing all sorts of other stuff. And I think maybe it's not so much, I don't know, we're not so much divided. There are still groups, or were in my high school. I went to a private Catholic high school and went to a public junior high and elementary, and we had some people that only were in one group or another, but like 90% of the students floated in and out of all the groups. And there wasn't a distinct label on people. And the other thing is, being in college still, there are a lot of things that I would deem as derogatory to call people that are commonplace in my dorm. Girls run up and down the hall and call each other bitches and hoes and sluts and think it's perfectly acceptable. I can't say that I think this is the most wonderful thing to go on in the world, but it's something like sometimes people say it jokingly, and I don't think they catch the meaning of what they're really saying. It's just something they've heard so many times in a song or seen so many times being said to someone else on TV. So, sorry it's not positive, but, you know.
I would like to know whether...
we should discuss the other side, too, because, I mean, that if you discuss it, if that's common and that happens in your dorm, where has it become okay to do that? You know, and why?
Well, I don't think it is okay to do that. I just think it's happening.
But why? Trixie, do people talk about not having sex? Do they talk about waiting till marriage or...
I have a lot of friends who do talk about that, and I have a lot of friends who don't. I have friends that go to the bar with, you know, like two distinct groups of people go to the bar together so that one group can make sure that some of our friends get home okay and that don't go home with other people, because at certain times of the night they would. And they say, well, I really don't want to, but I know that once I start drinking, I'm not going to be paying any attention whatsoever, so can you come along and please make sure I get back? And that type of thing. And my roommate, my freshman year, would have different people staying overnight, like frequently, like, you know, two nights a week or whatever, just staying and sleeping in our room, and sometimes sleeping up in her bed or sleeping on the floor or whatever, and she would get up in the morning and not know who they were. And things like that happened, and we started doing groups of people going out together. Groups of people who weren't drinking that would go out with the people who were, to make sure they were coming home safely or things like that. Because a lot of things that seemed to happen happened because people were intoxicated. Not that they wanted it to happen, that it was just something that when they were drunk, it seemed like a good idea. And my school could be completely different from, you know, everybody else's school too.
But I don't University of Iowa. We haven't heard from you back there.
Sober sex is good sex. Sober sex is good
sex. Do you want to amplify that at all? Or is it
Well, I think you make better judgments when you're sober, and I think judgments are important to sex. Like, you know, making kind decisions, making judgments. I think it's important to be. I think it's important to be in love. I think we keep bouncing around calling it sex, but I think making love is different than having sex. Making love with your partner is a good thing.
And being sober makes you more sensitive.
I think so.
Since we know that you get anesthetized by alcohol.
I guess I don't want to challenge that, the literalness of that. I agree with you in terms of, you know, use of alcohol, the drugs, etc. But on the other hand, there's an aspect to sex that is not sober in a more metaphorical sense. It's intoxicating. And I keep thinking about what you said about, you know, that we need to put sex in the context of the emotional and spiritual side of things. One of the things that I think sex and sexual relationships, whether consummated sexual relationships or actually physically touching sexual relationships or simply sexual attractions provide, is an expansion of our emotional range. Remember when I was like maybe 15 or so and I, you know, fell in love probably for the first time and was in the presence for like a week at a camp or something, and a presence of, you know, this other that I loved. And I was riding high for a week. I was in ecstasy, and I think that was my first real experience of emotional ecstasy as an adult or burgeoning adult. And I think also, I mean, you could say the same for despair, sort of. You know, I mean, there's a whole range of emotions that go along with sex. And there's a sort of intoxication to it that the poets talk about and so forth. And that's good. So, you know, just that.
Thank you.
Hey, I think that one of the things that I remember learning about sex and sexuality is that it is a source of integrity. It is relational, but it's also a source of our own personal integrity, because if we lie about who we are having sex with or why we are having sex, or keep it secret because we don't want that part of our self to be publicly known, we lose something. And I think that the reason for that is because who we are is sexual beings. And if we love the people that we love and we don't love the other people, then we are telling the truth about ourselves. So as I try to explain to my children why it's important to be careful about sex, one of the things I will say is because if you are not careful, you are lying. And lying is destructive. But if you are careful, you are being truthful about who you are inwardly. And that will have a holistic outcome that we all want.
Tied into that, my parents told me, don't make any promises you can't keep. And that's not just spoken promises, but acted out promises. And I wish I'd understood what they meant a little better. And now I think I have a little bit better idea of what that means. Well, what I think it means is that in the very act of making love with someone, there is a promise made that, you know, I give myself. That's what's happening there. And in that giving, I don't know, there seems to be a promise made that that's going to last beyond tomorrow morning breakfast, you know, and that if it doesn't, there's something that feels very, very wrong. And that that promise is just sort of inherent in the act of giving oneself. And I suppose, like anything else, you can become inured to that, that you can, you know, decide that such a thing as recreational sex exists and act that way. But I don't know.
Thank you. That's a really good point. Also related to that, I think I have talked to many ordained Lutheran pastors who are gay or lesbian, who are in loving relationships with partners who have to lie about it every day of their lives. It has to be a secret. Their parish can't support them and their family. They can have their highs and lows of their relationship, but it can't be public. And it's destructive to their being because they have to lie about it. And because if they don't lie about it, they lose their not only their job, but their calling in life. And it is a terrible thing to do to me. We were reading yesterday out of Ruth, and in the book of Ruth, the marriage contract is made publicly, and something about taking off your sandal, and I don't remember all the stuff, but there were 10 men there that heard a promise of marriage of Boaz to Ruth. I think his name is Boaz. And it was public because then it was open and honest. And I think my marriage being public means that everyone supports me and Jody in our marriage. We have tremendous social supports for our love. And gay and lesbian people are often denied that. And so I think your point is a very big one. Thank you. And thanks for adding to it, Christian.
Well, I've always felt, of course, that there's three reasons for having sex. One is making babies, propagating the race, which is very important. One is an expression of love, and that's the thing we've focused on almost entirely tonight, it seems. But there's a third, and you've made a casual reference to recreational sex. I guess I'd call it more a biological drive. It's a hunger in most people that we get hungry. And especially amongst young people, there's a strong drive, there's a strong urge. Now, I don't think it's healthy to tell them, no, you must wait till you have a loving relationship with someone, or preferably that you're married to. I haven't heard the word masturbation, for instance, mentioned at all tonight.
Well, it just was.
And I know that, I remember that we had Jocelyn Elders was the Surgeon General. Lost her job because she had the audacity to mention masturbation on the air. And I think we could just can't dismiss this biological urge toward sex and say that. Now I think that where much of the abuse of sexuality comes is when one partner is doing it for one reason and is deceiving his or her partner, who's doing it for a different reason. But if two people engage in biological sex or recreational sex, whatever term you want to say, I can't say that that's completely wrong.
Reactions to that? There's a little bombshell to go on. You might save a kid from being abused who happens to be in the next bedroom. Yeah. Little person, I mean, I think there is a reality to how much sex goes on and how sexual people are. And, I think you make an interesting point because a lot of child abuse comes out of that biological urge and whoever is the closest person at hand without any caring about the damage that's going to be done. So, two consenting adults have recreational sex.
That's different.
And that's a third area of sexuality. Maybe there's a way to channel the biological urges with consenting adults. I mean, it's an interesting point. Not everybody is in love with sex, right?
I kind of want to backtrack a little bit. When you said that you maybe suspect that you preach to the choir, I don't think so. Because I agree with what you said. We forget that we are sexual beings.
we see it. Our media has acknowledged it. The newspapers acknowledged it. The magazines have. But we as people, we don't want to discuss that. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to show it. I don't think.
Let's prevent people who are incarcerated and have, sex when they're incarcerated do not, come out and sort of dismiss that, but consider that when they were incarcerated that was something that was a necessity, and that's another thing that we just sort of pretend doesn't go on in our prisons and jails, but it's rampant.
I think even in our appearance, we try to dress down our sexuality or dress it up too much. We don't celebrate it. We can celebrate it. And I think, especially within the church, there is an unspoken dress code. And we won't even talk about that.
No, that hasn't always been true. Take a look at the next time your church does the Easter Vigil, pay attention to what's happening. It's the most sexual service ever. And that's at the center of the church. I mean, the ancient tradition is that the paschal candle is lowered repeatedly into the font and that wax is spilled into the font from the paschal candle. I mean, the church is not
by men in dresses.
Pardon?
By
men in dresses, yeah. Well, the church has not always been so weird about sex.
That's true. That's true. That's true. I do think you have a great point. Not everybody has sex can be in love, but then how do we? That's a great point. Then is there still healthy? It still can be healthy sex.
Well, I think even within Lutheran theology, there's a considerable theological imperative that underlies the importance of sex. I mean, sort of incarnation, an emphasis on incarnation, really glorifies the idea of being sexual beings, it seems to me. And there's a more current strain of theology that emphasizes the playfulness of God and the playfulness of our being as creatures of God, as children of God. So another aspect.
I think you brought up about it's creating a relationship and having respect and to me, respect is so key, and consideration and empathy for another person.
And as a person in a long-term relationship with someone, I find that sex is a response to so many things, including grief, and joy, and all kinds of ways in which sex is a balm and healing and a wonderful part of us. You made your hand up.
Well, I was going to say we've talked a lot about spiritual and social and so on, but there's one physical one that we haven't talked about, is the people that are sexually active live longer.
That might be why I'm getting white hair.
No, you're absolutely right.
I wanted to mention Ingrid. I didn't want to make a joke, but it ended up. I have been to two national assemblies, the one in Philadelphia and the one in Orlando, are the last two, and I had brought up to the floor the idea of what both homosexuality and sexuality, that every time I've addressed it to the national assembly, I've been shut down every time that it ended up. I could at least get it to a floor and get them to think about it. But each time our national Lutheran Church stand there saying they want to have now 7 more years of study. But ended up I addressed it 2 years ago and a year ago, or 3 years ago and a year ago, and it ended up 2 years ago they shot me down. And then last year, when I was in Orlando, they decided that they needed 7 more years of study of
sexuality.
You can't have too much study about sex.
You said Lutheran theology and sex in the same sentence. I was just thinking oxymoron.
I think one thing about this phrase came to me as I was thinking about what sex is and what it does as the component of reproduction, and it's the terminal driver. It is the essential driver of most anything that is alive, because without the union of it, and everything quits. I mean, the sun will keep shining, the earth will keep spinning around, but it's the terminal driver. It's the energy that has been, I would say, miscultivated, and I think the opportunities that we have as human beings to tend it and recultivate it into a real joyous, mindful, and respectful thing, there's a lot of hope there.
And on that note, I'm going to read you back the poem you've just written, and then we'll all go home and have sex.
There's different arrangements here than I do.
Where are your children?
Yeah. Unfortunately, they're here in Holden.
I didn't
come
here.
Thank you. You've all been wonderful. Now listen to your words. Kindly, lovingly, approximately, friendship, power balance, physical element that makes Christ's love known to me, a sacrament, befriend myself, embrace my self-worth, making connections with people, humorous, it's fun, tender lover, gentle, sensitive, thoughtful, respectful, aware of partner's needs. Training for relationships, mutuality, cherishing, boundaries, vulnerability, the opposite of power, intense bond, a source of integrity, relational and personal, expression of love, of hunger. You live longer, your blood pressure's down, terminal driver, energy, joyous, mindful of the other. Sober sex is good sex. Making love, it's intoxicating, riding high, emotional ecstasy. Good night.